started this show about 5 years ago because, well, I can only speak for myself. I was a little bit tired of people spouting off about the Constitution without ever taking the trouble to read it. That battle is yet to be won, but fortunately, I recently found that we have an ally. And the ally is a woman named Lauren Carroll, and she works for an organization called PolitiFact, which you might have seen in the newspapers. PolitiFact fact checks the claims made by politicians. Well, Lauren's focus, at least when she's on our program, is slightly different. She's fact-checking claims that people make about the Constitution. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about fact-checking the Constitution.
Your Weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
You know, we're really high tech at this radio show. We got computers and everything. it's not as bad as I make it sound. We do have computers. I have a computer. Wayne's got lots of computers. He's got lots of fancy equipment. And we actually do have a fairly decent social media presence. We have a website, of course, at montpelier.org. The station has its own website at wets.org. We've got a Facebook page, Your Weekly Constitutional Facebook page. And we even have a Twitter account. And I have to admit, I was a little bit reluctant on that last one because, you know, what can you say in 140 characters? Well, it turns out you can say a lot. And Twitter has a nice feature that lets me know every now and then that someone has followed our radio show on Twitter or when they've said nice things about us. And recently that happened. Recently, there was a tweet by a young woman named Lauren Carroll. And Lauren Carroll said the following. She said, "New favorite podcast. At Your Weekly," which happens to be our Twitter handle. Lauren Carroll was saying that we are her favorite podcast. And so, of course, I clicked on her icon and I saw that she works for an organization called PolitiFact. And that rang a bell because PolitiFact is one of those fact-checking organizations that's out there and that goes out and looks in the media and sees people make claims about this or that and fact-checks those claims and actually has a rating system. It has a spectrum on the one end of things that are truthful. And on the other end, the things are so false that they rate them as pants on fire. Well, it turns out, after Lauren and I traded a couple of tweets back and forth, that some of the fact-checking she's done has a very constitutional cast to it. It seems that people make all sorts of claims about what the Constitution says. It says this, it says that, and some of them are just flat out wrong. Well, that sparked a conversation, and eventually it sparked an interview. And here it is.
Hi, my name is Lauren Carroll, and I'm a reporter at PolitiFact in Washington, D.C. I'm a recent graduate of Duke University, where
I heard of that place.
Yeah.
That's a pretty impressive place.
Thanks. I studied political science there, and I also worked at the student newspaper, so I did a bit of journalism and politics, and that's how I ended up at PolitiFact now.
Journalism and politics, it sounds like the perfect preparation for this thing you mentioned called PolitiFact, but let's explain. What is PolitiFact?
PolitiFact is an independent fact-checking news organization out of the Tampa Bay Times, which is a newspaper down in Florida, but most of us are located in Washington, D.C., and we fact-check politicians, which means we take claims that a politician or sometimes a pundit or another sort of public figure says that maybe sounds fishy or simplistic or nuanced, and we dig into the claim. We do research, we talk to experts, we read reports, and eventually settle on a ruling anywhere between pants on fire for really ridiculous claims that are inaccurate, and then all the way to true, which means it is completely accurate and without any sort of problems. But we also have half true, mostly false, and false for those claims that are in between.
Well, I must say that both my wife and I have been fans of PolitiFact for years, and we noticed that you use a spectrum, which is itself sort of a nuanced approach to this, because as we all know, very few claims are absolutely, perfectly, in every respect, completely true, or pants on fire, as you say, which is the other side of the spectrum. And yet I think it was that latter category that really attracted my attention at the beginning when I first noticed this on the internet, because that's a pretty funny thing to ascribe to a politician.
Sure. I mean, that's usually reserved for claims that not only are totally wrong, but they're just absurd. So we give a lot of those claims for, you know, the kind of the chain emails that you might get from your aunt that are written in all caps and say, Obama's from Kenya, that kind of thing.
I just got one of those, and apparently he's taking over Texas.
Oh, yeah. Well, send that to me and maybe fact check that. I've been hoping to fact check something about the Texas military takeover, actually.
It's remarkable. They've got all kinds of soldiers down there. It's just remarkable. At any rate, I'm guessing then that a lot of politicians are not too happy when they hear from you. And there's one other thing I really do need to get out of the way. Is this at all a partisan endeavor? Are you guys a bunch of liberals or a bunch of conservatives?
I think you will find people who will say that we're a bunch of liberals or conservatives, depending on their own political beliefs. But we are staunchly independent and unbiased. We fact check people of both parties and people who aren't even politicians sometimes, but are public figures. So we pride ourselves on the fact that we do identify falsehoods and truths across the political spectrum. We are not partisan.
Tremendous. That's extremely important because, of course, neither are we, and we're educational, and we want to make sure that we treat everybody fairly. So one particular item that I saw recently had not to do specifically with politics, though all of them, to some extent, probably have something to do with politics, but it had more specifically to do with a claim about the Constitution. And that really, of course, makes our ears prick up. In fact, I've often explained that one of the reasons I started this radio show 5 years ago now was because I got a little bit tired of people claiming this or that about the Constitution. The Constitution says this, it requires that, or, you know, it clearly says this. And for the first time when I was reading a PolitiFact item, your item, I noticed that a fellow by the name of Cuomo, not the governor, but another fellow named Cuomo had made a pretty remarkable claim about the Constitution. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, Lauren.
Sure. Well, this was CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, who is the younger brother of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was tweeting with some people about some anti-Muslim protests and free speech. And somebody tweeted at him, "Too many people are trying to say hate speech doesn't equal free speech." And Cuomo responded saying, "It doesn't. Hate speech is excluded from protection. Don't just say you love the Constitution. Read it." And we immediately saw a ton of backlash against Chris Cuomo saying, "How can you say the Constitution doesn't protect hate speech?" And so we decided to look into that because, you know, with the Constitution, obviously there are things that are explicitly said and left out from the Constitution, but there's always some nuance given court rulings and other interpretations. So we wanted to see if there was any sort of truth in his claim.
So once again, he was saying the Constitution does not protect something called hate speech.
Yes, and hate speech.
And then he almost double-dog dared everybody to go and read the Constitution.
Right.
Don't just say that you love it, but go and read it, okay?
Yes.
So whatever now befalls Chris Cuomo, it's your own fault. Please go on.
Sure, and I mean, to Chris Cuomo's credit, he came out later and tried to clarify what he was saying, but I'll get to that in a minute. But hate speech is somewhat colloquially known as any sort of speech that is negatively targeting someone based on their personal traits like religion or race. It's the kind of thing that you probably know it when you hear it. But as we found out, the Constitution does protect hate speech just like it protects every other type of speech because of the free speech clause in the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Indeed it does. In fact, you used a phrase there that I think is very apropos. You say you know it when you see it or you know it when you hear it. Whenever someone says that, of course, it means they're unable to come up with a definition. And that is the problem with so-called hate speech. What I find hateful, you might not. And what you find hateful, I might not. And then there's the question of whether so-called hate speech was intended to be hateful or not intended to be hateful. The problem with it is that nobody knows exactly what it is. And when you can't come up with any kind of definition, We like to say that any restriction on such speech is void for vagueness. The First Amendment does protect such speech. In fact, it's the sort of speech that most often comes up in constitutional cases.
Sure. And, you know, one thing I did find out is that there are types of speech that aren't protected by the First Amendment, things like child porn or threats or something called fighting words, which are words that would likely draw somebody into a fight. And sometimes hate speech can get mingled up in those, like say you were threatening somebody because of their religion or their race, or you were starting a fight with somebody based on their ethnicity. Then in that case, or cases such as those, you likely would not have protection under the First Amendment. But it's not because it's hate speech, it's because they are things like threats or fighting words.
Precisely. I noticed you said that in your piece, and I appreciated that. But as you pointed out, these are very limited exceptions. A so-called true threat really has to be a threat, and pretty much at that moment that you're going to cause somebody bodily harm. The so-called fighting words exception is still technically good law, but it is essentially an exception that has disappeared because no one knows exactly what a fighting word is. What might make me want to punch you in the nose is something different than what might make you want to punch me in the nose. And so even these exceptions that you've identified are very narrow and very suspect and very rarely applied.
Sure. And to his credit, Chris Cuomo came out and said that he was talking about things like threats and fighting words, not hate speech specifically. And he specifically cited the Chaplinsky case, which is where the fighting words doctrine comes from.
Right.
But I did talk to some experts who said, like you just pointed out, that just because there was that decision, which was several decades ago, it likely would have been it would be decided differently today, and it might not stand anymore, though that's a hypothetical situation.
But actually, I think Chaplinsky's back in the 40s. I think it's a 1941 case. And if I recall correctly, the particular language that the defendant, and it was actually a prosecution in that case, the defendant used was something like, "You're a damn fascist," or something of that sort. Really? I mean, if someone called you a damn fascist today, would that justify you in some sense punching that guy in the nose?
I don't think I would.
Yeah, and would you even
know for that? But I'm not a judge, so I can't say.
Well, I've been called much worse than that, and the idea that there are certain trigger words which are going to render me incapable of resisting the urge to punch you or somebody else in the nose is a quaint concept, and I think it goes back to a simpler time when people really were much more concerned about words and much more concerned about regulating speech. And so I tend to agree with the experts that you cite that the so-called fighting words exception is very, very, in addition to being vague, it's just very suspect today. And so though it's technically good law, probably would be decided differently if Chaplinsky were prosecuted today.
Sure. And I mean, I talked to one expert who believes there's room in the Constitution to exclude some sort of hate speech from First Amendment protection. But he even admitted that most people would disagree with him and that it probably would not become law. But there is room to opine on the idea that there might be a way to constitutionally exclude hate speech.
Absolutely. Law professors and lawyers argue endlessly about these things. And the subject of hate speech has been very much a subject of a scholarly debate over the past few decades. Because, of course, it brings up the basic conflict between liberty on the one side, you know, free speech, free thought, and equality on the other. And it's pretty commonsensical to think that if you're going out and using racial epithets or gender epithets, that that's going to tend to have a negative effect on equality in society. And so people are legitimately concerned about those things. They don't want those things to be done. On the other hand, if you try to regulate them, well, then, you know, which epithet is acceptable and which is not? And what exactly, again, constitutes this so-called hate speech and what constitutes, in contrast, legitimate criticism? And so, sure, the debate goes on, but as you correctly pointed out, right now, and for a long time, the First Amendment to the Constitution has protected most forms of what people would casually call hate speech.
Sure. And another interesting angle to this is the fact that, like I said before, hate speech can be excluded from protection if it is a sort of fighting word or a threat. But the Supreme Court has ruled that there can't be an additional set of penalties because it is hate speech. Like, you can't have a bias motivated penalty that goes beyond the penalty that you would have just for saying a threat that isn't racially motivated, which I thought was interesting, especially given the fact that there are other sort of hate crimes, such as, you know, vandalizing a mosque or assaulting someone because of their race, where you can have an extra penalty, or at least in many cases, there are extra penalties for that bias motivation, as opposed to just an assault or vandalism without that layer of making it a hate crime, if that makes sense.
It makes a great deal of sense. And Lauren, you've identified, you know, sort of the cutting edge of this whole area. On the one hand, it's pretty much universally illegal for me to go out and hit somebody over the head. Is it then appropriate for the state to add to the penalty if I hit that person over the head because he's a Muslim or because she's a woman? Well, those statutes exist, but they're still very controversial because we're no longer just penalizing the action of me hitting somebody. We're penalizing the thought behind it. Mm-hmm. And that is a very dicey and still very controversial area. But we could go on about this forever. We could devote a whole episode to it. I think to bring it back, Chris Cuomo's statement was, well, how did you rate it?
We rated it false.
Mm-hmm.
Because as it stands now, there is a general consensus that hate speech itself is protected by the Constitution, though there is some nuance.
Tremendous. And it's that nuance that kept him from getting his pants on fire, I'm guessing.
Yes, probably.
But note to Chris Cuomo, whom I don't know personally, and I'm sure is a fine fellow, just be very careful when you dare people to read the Constitution. They might actually go out and do it.
That was some of the feedback I got from some experts was, I disagree with his statement, but I do agree with his contention that people should read the Constitution.
Well, we agree with that too, Lauren.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Lauren Carroll, a reporter for a fact-checking organization called PolitiFact. And today, Lauren and I are fact-checking some constitutional claims. Now we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back, and we'll speak some more with Lauren Carroll. Stick around. Well, Doug Smith, what a pleasure it is to see you today here in the studio.
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I am doing so well. I don't know. I just feel sort of puffed up and proud and
en forme, as the French say.
There we
are.
Yeah, yeah. Omelette du fromage.
Yeah, I love the cheese.
I would like to go to the hotel. I know all kinds of French.
Yes.
Well, that's an appropriate thing, isn't it?
It is.
Because I'm guessing we're going to talk about some French guy.
We could, if you'd like.
We could, but we're not going to.
I hadn't planned on it.
Oh, darn. Okay, well, that's all right. You know, Marquis de Lafayette, you know, the Hermione, right?
Well, Marquis de Lafayette did used to make speeches, and oddly enough, we are going to talk about a speech today.
Okay, well, there's our nexus. All right, Doug, what do you got for us?
So, I've got this great question about a very famous speech, and I'd like to pose that as a quiz.
Oh, well, that's a very good thing. So I guess we need a contestant. Is that the hint you're sort of driving? Do we have a contestant on the line?
Hello?
Well, yeah, I think we do. And it sounds like a young lady. I'm just guessing here. What is your name, young lady?
My name is Rachna.
Rachna. That's an interesting name. What kind of name is that?
It's Indian.
An Indian name. Very, very nice name. Okay, Rachna, are you ready for a quiz about a speech?
I am.
Okay, Doug, have at her.
All right. So I'm going to ask the question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
I am.
What speech is the U.S. president required to give annually to Congress? Is it A, the State of the Union speech, B, the Thanksgiving Proclamation, C, the speech that recognizes election results.
Oh, that would be important.
Or D, none. The Constitution does not require a speech.
Ooh. Can we hear those choices again? I'm thinking Rechna is hesitating here.
Yeah, what speech is the U.S. president required to annually give to Congress? Is it A, the State of the Union speech, B, the Thanksgiving Proclamation, C, a speech recognizing election results, or D, none, the Constitution does not require a speech?
All right. Well, Rechna, you've heard him twice. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm going to go with A, State of the Union. I'm pretty sure it's required.
Now, why do you think the State of the Union is more required than, for example, election results, choice C, which seemed to me to be also very important?
I think if you have to do something annually, the State of the Union is definitely the most comprehensive address that a president can give.
Okay. Well, what about Thanksgiving? I mean, they pardon the turkey every year. That seems to be extremely important, at least to the turkey.
I feel like that's not in the Constitution, Stuart.
There's no turkey in the Constitution? It's
there's
our national
no turkey
bird.
There's no article in the Constitution last time I checked.
There's no turkey article, and I don't think I can budge her off of choice A, Doug. Did she get the right one?
Did she say there's no turkey in Washington? I missed that.
Maybe not in the Constitution itself. You know, Ben Franklin did want the turkey to be our national bird.
That's true. It's a proud animal.
It's a proud animal. So I'm going with the turkey, right? Right?
Well, sadly, you're both wrong.
Oh,
it is D.
Is it D?
None. The Constitution does not require a speech.
Oh, Doug, geez Louise.
Article 2, Section 3 requires the president to periodically give Congress the State of the Union. But it wasn't until the 20th century that was more than just a report, really something written out and submitted to Congress. It wasn't really until the age of TV and radio that it became the big deal that it is now, which is largely drama.
Which is largely drama, but I'll tell you what. That is such a close one. I vote. Mark, I'm looking at you, buddy. There are three of us in this room in the studio here talking to Rechna. And Mark is voting with me on this one, Doug. I think we're gonna have to give her a special dispensation because I get your point, but on the other hand, there is a report that's required. Hey!
That is not a speech.
Okay, Rechna, you didn't technically get it right, but I think we're going to give you a T-shirt anyway, just because I'm a nice guy.
That is a nice guy.
You are a nice guy, Stuart. Mark's a nice guy, but Doug is not.
Not at all.
Thank you, Rechna. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. That's MONTPELIER.org. Give us your T-shirt size, and we will have one in the snail mail to you, along with your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a delightful conversation with Lauren Carroll, who's a reporter for an organization called PolitiFact. It's an independent fact-checking journalism website. And before the break, Lauren and I were talking about a statement by Chris Cuomo that was not exactly accurate about the Constitution. And now we're going to do another one. What else do you have for us today, Lauren?
So today we have a claim from Lawrence O'Donnell, who is a pundit on MSNBC, mm-hmm. talking about the upcoming presidential election. And he said, the president and vice president can't be from the same state. Thinking about former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and current Florida Senator Marco Rubio, both Republicans, both running for president.
And that is a fascinating question because, of course, he has a close personal and political relationship with Marco Rubio, which already makes their current rivalry, you know, quite a soap opera. But now on top of that, there's this constitutional issue about whether they can both whether they ultimately could end up on the same ticket or not. And the last time I remember something like this coming up, I think it was back with the younger George Bush, with W, and his vice president, Dick Cheney. Weren't they both from Texas?
Yes, they were both from Texas. And to skirt the issue that we'll talk about in a couple minutes, Dick Cheney actually registered to vote in Wyoming. So
oh, yes, I remember that. I remember that. Okay. Well, let's go back to this one then. Is it in fact true what Lawrence O'Donnell said, that the president and vice president cannot be constitutionally from the same state?
No, that's actually not true.
Really? Yep. That's going to be a surprise to a lot of people. Please go on.
Sure. I mean, I myself had heard this claim before, and when I saw it come up as false, I was surprised, but happy that we were able to clarify this issue. There are some issues in terms of election strategy to running from the same state, but nothing in the Constitution says that they can't be from the same state. It all originates back in the original days of our country and election processes then, when the Electoral College would vote for two men for president, and the person who got the most votes would become president, and the person who got the second most votes would become the vice president. Obviously, that's not the case anymore. We vote separately, or the Electoral College votes separately for president and vice president. But anyway, at the time, they wanted to reduce the power of overly populous states and encourage Electoral College members to not only vote for people they have political alliances with. So they said that the Electoral College members, when they voted for two men, could not vote for two men from the same state. That doesn't mean that two people from the same state couldn't serve as president and vice president. It's just that they might not have the same vote makeup, if that makes sense.
It makes a great deal of sense.
Today.
In fact, I noticed this is a huge issue. We've discussed that there was a huge issue back in the day. And some time ago, I interviewed Rick Beeman from the University of Pennsylvania, who was telling me all about the Constitutional Convention and suggested why that might have been a requirement in the original Constitution, Article 2, which talks about the president. They were very, very concerned about electing the president. That's why they established this strange body called the Electoral College, which was supposed to be a group of wise men that would sort of modify and calm the passions of the masses. So these guys are going to get together. But they were even worried about these wise men. They were afraid that these wise men might be really parochial, but they might really only know about or support people from their own state. And so back in the day, when they were going to be voting for two people, and when the top vote getter was going to be president and the second place guy was going to be vice president, they said, okay, one requirement, you can't vote a complete homeboy ticket. You know, you can't just vote for your favorite sons. You got to vote for at least one guy from another state.
Yes. And
right.
And so this could have political implications. For example, thinking of Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, they're from Florida, which has quite a few Electoral College votes. And so if the Electoral College, if they were on the same ticket and the Electoral College had to vote for president and vice president, they couldn't necessarily vote for both Jeb and Marco, which if it's a close race, that could really affect the ticket. And you could, for example, have Jeb Bush win the presidency, but Marco Rubio not win the vice presidency, or vice versa.
Okay, so, let me restate that so that I understand it. Basically, it comes down to this. If it's a close race, and if the Republicans nominate Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, it could cost one of them Florida's electoral votes, because the electors from the state of Florida could not vote for both Rubio and Bush.
Sure, that's exactly right.
Okay, so basically it's going to come, these electors are going to be actually have something to do, and they might actually have to debate among themselves as they're figuring out how to cast their votes. Okay, who's going to vote for, they'd probably pick voting for Bush, the top of the ticket, rather than voting for Rubio. And so it could cost Rubio the vice presidency.
It's possible. I mean, I don't want to try and predict the future, but
yeah,
you know,
but
that wouldn't be the first time that Florida's been the deciding factor in a close call.
I lived in Florida back in 2000. I remember that election. Florida does seem to be the sort of poster child for all the problems with the Electoral College. Okay, so essentially then, to go back to it, you could have Bush and Rubio both running, both registered in Florida. They wouldn't pull a Cheney and have one of them move to another state, but then they would risk at least Rubio losing all of Florida's electoral votes, and that's quite a few.
Yep, that's the case. And so we rated Lawrence O'Donnell's claim false, because nothing in the Constitution says that the president and the vice president can't be from the same state. But he is hitting on an issue that exists in the Electoral College, but not the issue that he was stating.
Okay, so I guess probably what he's most guilty of is sort of oversimplifying things here. Or no, it goes beyond that. He actually was wrong, and that's, I guess, why you called it false, because it's really not a prohibition. It's simply a voting issue.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Lauren Carroll from PolitiFact, that was a fascinating discussion and one that we might have to come back to in 2016. And wouldn't that be interesting?
Oh, that would be great. We can put this article out there again and again.
And you know, Lauren, that brings us to another very interesting question that's been much in the news lately. It involves Ted Cruz, another fellow running for president. And it turns out that some people are saying, you know, Ted Cruz is not really American. He's a Canadian. Can he be the president of the United States?
Well, you know, I'm not here to speculate on what kind of votes Ted Cruz will get in the Republican primary, but I can say that it seems, despite the fact that Ted Cruz was born in Canada, he is eligible to run for president.
Whoa, wait a minute. He's Canadian. And his dad was a Cuban. I mean, he's just a foreigner, isn't he? I mean, kind of foreigner like Barack Obama was from Kenya, right?
That would get a pants on fire to claim that Barack Obama is from Kenya. But Ted Cruz was born in Canada while his dad was working there, but his mom was actually born in Delaware, so he is a naturalized citizen.
A natural born citizen.
What?
Natural born citizen.
Yes,
that's
the
key.
Natural born citizen.
Yeah, in fact, it's Article 2 of the Constitution that actually has a requirement, and it actually says a person who's going to be president has to be 35, has to have lived here for 14 years. And then says that the president must be a natural-born citizen. And you're saying that even though he was born in Canada and even though his dad was not a U.S. citizen, he still qualified as a natural-born citizen?
Yes, because he has an American mother, and so he got her citizenship at birth. And the same issue standed for John McCain, who was born in Panama while his dad was stationed there, for Mitt Romney, who was born in Mexico, and had Barack
Obama. It was George Romney, wasn't it? It was Mitt's dad. That was
it.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. No, I remember George Romney because I'm from Michigan originally, and I remember he was governor of Michigan, and then he decided he wanted to run for president. And people pointed that out. They said, wait a second, you were born, where was it again? Was it
Mexico?
Mexico. So how can you be president? But his parents were U.S. citizens.
Sure. And had Barack Obama been born in Kenya, which he most certainly was not, he would have the same thing because his mother's American. And Barry Goldwater, who's from my home state of Arizona, was born there before Arizona was even a state. And he was eligible to run for president. So all signs point to yes. Ted Cruz can. And this originates, back in the early days of the country and their understanding of what a natural born citizen was at the time of the colonies.
Now, if I recall correctly, the scholarship shows, and there have actually been articles, at least one article written on this subject, that the common accepted meaning of natural born at the time of our Constitutional Convention, so this is the meaning that our founders would have incorporated into the document, is simply a citizen from the moment of birth.
Yes, and my colleague Steve Contorno, who wrote this article for PolitiFact, cited some of this scholarship, and he talked about how, you know, during the time of the British colonies, the English believed that, you know, if you were born to a British citizen outside of the British Empire, you were still considered a British citizen. So it's believed that that's what the founding fathers of the United States understood the term natural born citizen to believe when they were framing the Constitution and outlining these requirements.
So an Englishman is still an Englishman, even if he's born in India or born in the colonies in the United States or what within the North American colonies, you're still an Englishman no matter where you were born.
Sure. Or, you know, if you are born on a trade mission to somewhere outside the colonies, as long as you're born to somebody who has English citizenship.
Okay, so the circumstances of your birth are very important, but the geographical location is not as, well, in fact, it's not important at all, it seems, because it just matters if you were a citizen at that moment.
Exactly.
And so therefore, you didn't have to go through what we call a naturalization process.
No, and even if you had people who have to go through that naturalization process, you know, immigrant from Mexico or anywhere else to the United States, you couldn't be president because the Constitution specifically says natural born.
Yeah, it does. Now, that's an interesting issue because, of course, there are those who argue that subsequent amendments, most notably the Equal Protection Clause, might have modified Article II's requirement of being a natural-born citizen. So that is, like most areas of constitutional law, subject of some debate. But the last time that was really people thought it might be relevant was when Arnold Schwarzenegger was making noises like he was going to run for president. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people, all of whom, all the people we've mentioned, were Americans from the moment of their birth, regardless of the particular geographical location they were born. And that includes Ted Cruz of Canada.
Yeah. And I mean, as you mentioned, that there is possibly some room for interpretation from the courts here. But in this article, we talked to some experts on the issue who said it's very likely that the courts don't even want to touch this issue just because it is, in the wording, so vague and it's so politically charged that it doesn't seem like it's a likely issue to come up for any further clarification anytime soon.
No, it's not. And I'm not going to geek out too much here, get too much down in the weeds, but there are basically two reasons for that. First, if it's one issue that we call standing. You or I may decide we don't like Ted Cruz, and so we might file a lawsuit saying, hey, he can't be president, but we would not have standing to challenge that because we don't have a particular harm that we've suffered different from any other American. Now, if Ted Cruz ran and one of his opponents sued over that, well, then that person might have standing to get into court. But even if that were the case, even if an actual lawsuit with a plaintiff with standing got before the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, the court might very well punt on this issue, calling it, as I think you referenced earlier, a political question, something that it's simply not going to touch because it thinks it should be resolved through the political process rather than through the judicial process. That's why we can't cite to a particular court opinion deciding this issue, because it's just not gotten to the Supreme Court and may never.
Right. But for now, Ted Cruz can run for president.
Well, I'm sure he's very happy to hear that. So thanks for clarifying that, Lauren.
You're welcome.
Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we are just fact-checking up a storm here with Lauren Carroll of PolitiFact, an independent fact-checking journalism website. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Lauren Carroll. Stick around.
Liar. James Madison's personal server, the slave Paul Jennings, was an eyewitness to the events of the evening in 1814 when British troops burned the U.S. Capitol. In his memoir, published in 1865, he wrote that it was not Dolly Madison who saved the portrait of Washington, but in fact was the White House doorkeeper, John Saussay, a Frenchman, and McGraw, the president's gardener. In his memoir, he said, "Mrs. Madison would have had no time for doing it. It would have required a ladder to get it down. Saussay and McGraw took it down and sent it off on a wagon, with some large silver urns and such other valuables as could be hastily got hold of. When the British did arrive, they ate up the very dinner and drank the wines, etc., that I had prepared for the president's party. In 2009, President Barack Obama held a ceremony at the White House to honor Jennings for his contributions to saving the Gilbert Stuart painting and other valuables. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Lauren Carroll, who's a reporter for PolitiFact, and she's just helping me, or I should say I'm helping her, to explode some myths about the Constitution, some misstatements, some mischaracterizations, and now it's time for another one.
Well, this is an oldie but goodie. It's Herman Cain.
I remember Herman Cain.
Yeah, he ran for president on the Republican side in 2012. Mm-hmm. Didn't make it past the primary, but was a pretty popular public figure. And back at the time, he made a couple claims about the Constitution that we fact-checked. And we're bringing them up here again today.
What did Mr. Cain claim about our Constitution?
He said, in the U.S. Constitution, that, quote, there's a little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Oh, no.
Yep.
I hear this all the time.
You know,
I'm going to let you tell. What's the problem with that claim?
Well, you know, this language is familiar, and for maybe people who haven't spent a ton of time reading our founding documents, they hear it and they know that it came from our founding fathers, but they don't know exactly where it came from. But the clause about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness was not from the Constitution. It was from the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, boy.
In his speech, he said something about we have the right to abolish the government as citizens. But that also is from the Declaration of Independence when Thomas Jefferson was saying, "Hi, Britain, we want to abolish this government and create our own." So he's got it wrong there. He's got his documents mixed up.
Or in the immortal words of Mr. Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
What Jefferson was saying was, hey, you know, we left this England place because it was bogus. So if we don't get some cool rules ourselves, pronto, we'll just be bogus too. Yeah?
That's what the Declaration of Independence was about. It was about abolishing a government, or at least declaring our independence from it. And that's why that language was so important. It was, as Jefferson said very famously, you know, we're going to justify what we're doing. We're going to explain to the world why it's important for us to declare our independence despite these political bands that have held us together for so long. And that's a very different document from a constitution.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's an argument to be made that a lot of the, you know, the reasons why we declared independence and the feelings behind that declaration played out in the Constitution, in the government that they created. But that doesn't mean that those immortal words are physically in that document.
That's right. And there are several different levels of criticism. The one that you pointed out in your piece, and I'm very glad that you did, or that your colleague, Dan. Who's your colleague who wrote this one?
This is my colleague Willoughby Mariano, who's actually with PolitiFact Georgia, which is one of our state affiliates down at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Well, Willoughby did a very good job pointing out that perhaps from a legal perspective, the most important distinction between these two documents is that the Constitution is law.
Right.
I mean, the Constitution is our fundamental law, and it's the one that courts will frequently cite when they're making decisions. It's the one we have to obey. Whereas the Declaration is a marvelous piece of rhetoric and an extremely important document, but it's not law. But there's something that's a little bit more fundamental here, and if I may, I'm just going to go off on a little riff here, and that is the difference between revolution and constitutionalism. Now, we had to have the revolution in order to have the establishment of a new government, but those are two different things. And often today in current politics, I will see people making references to revolutionary thoughts like we need to abolish the government, or you know, the government's been oppressing us, therefore it's time for us to revolt. Well, not exactly. I mean, 11 years after we had our independence, we went out and established our own government of us, the people. And, you know, maybe the time for revolution passed. And, you know, maybe we should be talking more about the Constitution today and a little bit less about the Declaration. At any rate, Lauren, I appreciate your clarifying that.
No problem. And one little funny note that I want to leave with is that the full quote that Herman Cain said was, "I know that there are some people that are not going to reread the Constitution and enforce the Constitution. So for benefit for those that are not going to read it because they don't want to go by the Constitution, there's a little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
Oh, boy.
And then we had a funny quote from a scholar that helped us out with this piece who said, "It might be a good thing if Mr. Cain would undertake that task," talking about reading the Constitution.
Okay, Lauren, I think we've got one more, and we've been saving the best for last. I believe it involves a woman called Michelle Bachmann?
Yes, Michelle Bachmann is a former Republican member of Congress who ran for president back in 2012, but she is no longer a politician, but still a very public figure.
But she still lives on, and the particular claim that she made in this case, she made several years ago, didn't she?
Yes, this was back in 2009. She said the Constitution only requires her to tell the census, quote, "how many people are in our home."
Oh, I remember this. There was that whole big controversy over the census. I think it was the 2010 census then. Census is supposed to be taken every 10 years. And she, among others, objected to all the questions. And there was also an objection that there were private organizations, some of which you know, allegedly had some sort of political bias, that were being contracted with to do this census taking. So there were all sorts of controversies. This was just the last census we did. And so she was what sort of leading a census resistance movement, wasn't she?
Yes, because just as you were saying, there was the private group ACORN, if you remember.
Yes, yes, I do.
They had some political issues and are seen as a partisan organization. So Michelle Bachmann was saying that at least she and her family were not going to fully participate with the census, which can bring a fine of several hundred dollars, actually.
Wow, okay. Yeah, let's go back to the Constitution. The Constitution itself actually does call for this, and it does every 10 years, and I think you quote the relevant language or in your piece, don't you?
"Representation and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall be shall by law direct."
Okay, that's the census clause, and it's very, very important. It may seem very mechanical. What's the big deal? But think about this. We were establishing back in 1787 a constitutional republic that had several different entities within it, notably within Congress, that are going to be representative. And in order to figure out who gets to vote, how many votes come from each state, you got to get a head count.
Yep. But it doesn't say specifically what kind of questions need to be answered, which I guess is what Michelle Bachmann was trying to say. However, the Constitution does give Congress the right to make those laws about what somebody has to answer.
In fact, that's that last clause you read, "in such manner as Congress shall by law direct."
Yes.
And has Congress actually done that? Have they actually passed a statute that says that you shall answer these questions?
That they have.
Yeah, and that's what you were referring to, wasn't it? If you don't answer the census guy or woman when she comes to the door, you could get a fine, couldn't you?
Yes, and a couple experts told us that the census usually does not enforce those fines, but they exist. So you are compelled by law to answer the questions that the census brings as set by Congress, and the Constitution says that Congress sets those laws. So it doesn't say directly in the Constitution that she's required to say anything other than how many people are in her home, But it does say that Congress can force her to say those things.
Indeed, so, and that's before we go on beyond that. That probably seems odd to a lot of people. In fact, the first time I read it, it seemed rather odd to me. Wait a second, you can make me answer these private questions? You know, what about the Fourth Amendment? I mean, maybe there are some privacy issues there. I don't think it's ever been litigated, but just looking at the text itself, again, this is a very important thing. It deals with apportionment primarily within the House of Representatives, but then apportionment for purposes of the Electoral College and the election of president. This is a huge issue, and it goes to the very fundamental functioning of our democratic republic. And that's why Congress has this extraordinary power to basically say, you shall answer our questions. And it's not just been about headcounts. In fact, I think from the very first census back in 1790, they asked about more than just how many people live here.
Yes, they also asked at the time for race and gender and whether they were free or slaves at the time.
Very important issues, and I think subsequent censuses have asked about, you know, how many men are there of military age? Another important question, you know, how big an army could we raise? And then, of course, in recent years, as all sorts of federal funding has been directed to various places based upon issues of age or gender or race or ethnicity or poverty levels or whatever it is, the census form has gotten longer and longer.
Sure. And, you know, I can't speak for the privacy issues here and what exists there, but experts and people who work for the census told us for this article that the purpose is to help develop laws and regulations that reflect the country and to help us have a full understanding of the population, which, you know, in turn helps create better laws.
Right. And the privacy issue has been addressed also through statute, because if you're a census worker and you actually release individually identifiable information, you're going to look at several years in the slammer and a very, very hefty fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
So there, Congress is at least trying to balance privacy issues on the one hand with a fundamental need for this information on the other. So in other words, it's very clear. The Constitution gives Congress the power to require answers to these questions. Congress has required answers to these questions. In fact, you can be fined if you don't answer them. So what did you all determine about Michelle Bachmann's statement that you only have to give a head count?
Well, we decided to rate her claim our lowest rating, which is pants on fire.
Pants on fire.
Not only was the claim false, but it also was sensationalistic and might have, you know, inspired people not to comply with the law. So it was just absurd. So we led to pants on fire.
Pants on fire and still smoking a little bit, even all these years later, I'm sure. And we're hoping that now that we've had this fascinating discussion, would you mind coming back on the show from time to time when you get some of these other egregious constitutional claims or maybe some true constitutional claims made by public figures and we can talk about them again?
Absolutely. The Constitution is always timely and, of course, is going to be a big topic of discussion going into the 2016 election. So I'm sure there will be plenty of opportunity to talk about these things.
Well, Lauren Carroll of PolitiFact, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Lauren Carroll from PolitiFact. And thanks to the folks at PolitiFact for all the good fact-checking work that they do. Wasn't she great? I think we're going to have her on again. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, so let's try to be accurate, shall we?